Welcome to Unstructured Unlocked,
a podcast where listeners discover how enterprise leaders are confidently automating document intake and accelerating their workflows to increase capacity and drive top-line revenue.
I'm co-host Michelle Gouveia.
And I'm co-host Chris Wells. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Unstructured Unlocked. I'm your co-host, Chris Wells.
I'm co-host Michelle Gouveia.
And today we're joined by CEO of Tribble, Sunil Rao. Sunil, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Yeah, I'm excited about this one.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little about who you are and what it is that you do over at Tribble?
Great. So who am I? Sunil, nice to meet you. And I'm the CEO of Tribble. We're a company that started a year ago in April, last year, 2023. And the thesis for the company has been, how do we automate the function within companies that ends up being the bottleneck in a lot of sales cycles when it comes to technical sales? So for those of you familiar with B2B SaaS companies, a lot of the time you have this role called a sales engineer. And my co-founder and I, Ray Shipley, we were SEs in a previous life, and we've kind of experienced the pains of being this role that's always in demand, but there are never enough people in that role within the company. And that's because they usually are the ones that really understand your product very, very well. And they're the ones that don't scale very well internally. So the thesis was, hey, can we scale that type of function at most companies? And if we look at the roles that those people have and the kinds of jobs that they do, you can kind of look at a lot of the tasks that they complete within sales cycles and start seeing, hey, like what parts of this are automatable? What parts of this should be automated? So that very much was kind of like the opening act, if you will, of like, let's automate this role. And then we very much narrowed the focus over the last course of the year to focus in on very specific workflows that these people participate in, like RFPs and information security questionnaires, which typically inundate these teams across these companies with this workload that comes in that's beyond what they typically do, which is helping salespeople close deals. So that's Tribble in a nutshell, and there's a much longer version of that, but I'm sure we can talk about it as we discuss.
Sounds great. Michelle, you ever see any really massive RFPs or security questionnaires in the insurance space?
We don't use paper questionnaires or anything like that. It's fully digital now in the insurance space.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, there are so many places where I think something like Tribble could add efficiency in there. So I'm looking forward to hearing more of like how you're thinking about the business, where you're focused on now, and then jumping into some of the insurance use cases that sound very similar to what you're doing, or maybe even that you have identified yourself. The insurance industry is ready and eager to have, I think, more trustworthy automation solutions.
You know, it's funny. I had a meeting, Michelle, just a couple of days ago with an insurance company, a pretty large insurer, and the framework for the conversation was very much this. It's like, this is probably a high leverage generative AI use case you can tackle with relatively low risk. And I think that's what's top of mind for a lot of execs right now, because there's a lot of uncertainty in how you take this tech and put it into production. And there's all kinds of discussions. And I mean, when you talk to tech companies, they're typically like you guys, like you're typically at the forefront of taking this tech and making it part of your day-to-day processes. But of course, as we know, insurance companies and other large verticals that it takes longer for this tech to diffuse into, they tend to be a little bit more methodical about how to incorporate this into a core business process. Like, you don't want the core business shutting down because you've taken a super risky bet. So in the context of this discussion, it was just, hey, you probably have salespeople. They're probably spending a disproportionate amount of time juggling Word documents or Google Docs that are heavy in prose, understanding things and creating these output formats like proposals. Can we drive some efficiency there so they can spend more time selling? And then that becomes the, okay, that looks like a pretty good area to start exploring this technology and seeing where it goes. So that's kind of one of the many conversations, Michelle, I would say, but squarely in insurance, I think it's a very high leverage use case. At least that's what we're hearing from our customers.
That's exciting. So I want to hear you talk a little bit, Sunny, about sort of state of the union when it comes to generative AI, especially with these big enterprise companies. It sounds like you in a similar fashion to myself, I see a lot of excitement and people asking questions and everyone's like, hey, how do you do RAG and how should we do RAG and all of these kinds of these types of things. What are you seeing in terms, you talked about that diffusion through the organization. How far has Gen AI penetrated, or is it still, it's sort of like we're dilly dallying with it. We're not really doing anything. What are you seeing?
You know, it's something that came up. I was in San Francisco yesterday and I had a coffee with the VC and we were just chatting about the space that we're in. And he'd mentioned that they put together some sort of a survey where they highlighted the top 100 use cases that are being used actively today across industries for generative AI. And he has yet to still send me that report. I'll share it with you once I get it. But one of the interesting things he mentioned to me was like, actually in the top 10, creative use cases didn't pop up, which was very counterintuitive to me because I figured everyone's using Midjourney in some variant of DALL-E or Midjourney to generate. I can tell you right now, all of the decks that we present, you can almost like immediately tell it's like generated imagery. It's just such a low value use.
Weird case. Fingers in all of your decks.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, not the, I think those were gang signs, but whatever that, that might be. Yes, weird figures indeed. And it was interesting to me that didn't make its way to the top. And I do have to dig into the data because it might be that it's like companies that offer that as a service aren't as prevalent within production in these orgs. Maybe that's the lens with which this was looked at because it's B2B. But the net of it is like sales tech is permeating very quickly. It sounds like a lot of people are taking risks on implementing software. Like I don't know about you, but my LinkedIn in mail is... It is in a situation right now. So it's like, I look at that and I look at the amount of email that we're getting that's becoming, you know, it is a little bit more personalized than it was a year or 2 years ago, but it's very clear that it's like picking random things from my work history and cobbling it together with some other nonsensical things. And so that's happening at scale. And you're seeing a lot of smaller companies like build tech like this and scale up to like 1 million, 2 million in ARR very quickly. So that tells me that this sales tech is being adopted and showing up in the enterprise faster than some of the other areas. But that's at least what I'm seeing preliminarily. I think in our own experience, it's a little bit more involved to validate whether or not this is something they're willing to put into the business process. There's a lot of questions around security, a lot of CISO conversations. Where's this data going? Is it being sent to some third-party API? How are you thinking about obfuscation? So top level, those are some of the considerations I'm seeing.
So a question for you on that, because I also ignore some of my LinkedIn and mail now because I just know I just need to. And then also a ton of things coming into email that you can very clearly tell same thing as what you're experiencing, right? They've swabbed your LinkedIn. It's one reference to something or on your website and they, you know, looks like you do work in this area, et cetera, et cetera. But as you identified and as we're identifying just as consumers of that, it's not very high quality AI, right? And so I can't imagine that even if a company is getting to that 1 to 2 million in ARR very quickly, that they become very sticky from a performance standpoint. And so what are the steps you think that a company that's providing some type of AI solution really needs to go through in terms of validation, testing, like to really become credible, both from with existing customers and then being able to tell the right story when they're in that room pitching their solution against the broad swath of other AI solutions that are just coming up seemingly every day.
I'm going to take notes on this answer, by the way.
I gave the use case that I think is actually most prevalent, because once again, it comes back to the situation of risk analysis and like, how quickly can I get something stood up and am I willing to take a risk here? So I think with this email and, you know, this outreach kind of use case, everyone's trying to generate leads. Everyone's trying to generate pipe outbound right now. The baseline, you know, a lot of CROs will say, like the worst BDRs are not doing the best job. So this maybe even just lifts that a couple of basis points. So it's definitely an improvement, but it's not a good improvement because now there's a deluge of generated emails coming to people's inboxes and to people's LinkedIn emails. So I think from that perspective, it's definitely not the best use case from a durable business standpoint. And I think that's where you're coming from, Michelle. It's like, how do you How do you create something that's meaningful and generates value over time, as opposed to like a spike of like people experimenting with it and then it dissipates? In our experience, and this is the reason why we're not building in that space specifically, we've specifically looked at this sales engineering role and thought about the deeper workflow that we can address for that individual in that company, in that role. And for us, the value comes from how much can you take off of that person's plate consistently with quality, right? And I think if we, as we double click and triple click into that role, like one of the things we've come across early days is, hey, like we can take a fairly complex RFP and we can process it and we can come back with answers, but we can only answer about 50% of it, right? So then the question is, well, what does a person do in that situation? Well, at Indico, maybe it's they hit up Chris and they're like, Chris, for these five questions, I need your help, right? So we thought about, how does that fit into the workflow of the individual? Is it a company that uses Slack? Do they use Teams? That's probably how they usually reach out to the other person. Can Tribble just do that? So we try to graft onto the process of answering this as a team. Tribble joins the team and Tribble ends up becoming a team member that goes out and fetches the answers from different people. So we think that allows it to become a team member in a continued way, which is a little bit stickier than like this one-shot experiment that you go out and try and, you know, you can turn off. So the question I always ask myself is like, hey, if someone turned off the switch for Tribble, like what's the immediate pain you would feel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two thoughts springing out of that. One, it gives me great comfort that I'm no longer ignoring an email written by a human. It makes me feel better. And then two, the word co-pilot is like way overused today, but it sounds like you're taking advantage of one of the most exciting aspects of these models, which is if you give them tools, and in this case, the human beings are kind of the tool, right? If you give them access to the tools they need, they can, their capabilities expand exponentially. And I think that approach is part of the recipe here.
Yeah, it absolutely is, Chris. And yes, co-pilots, like there's a no shortage to the number of co-pilots available today. I think for us, and this is when we talk about agents, and I know that's another word that will be hyped and, you know, everyone will claim to have agents and all that good stuff. But for us, it really is, hey, the thing that we are building, does it have agency to select from a set of tools that it has access to and dynamically use them in order to complete the task at hand? And for us, it's when we talk about agents, it's very much the agent that will facilitate this business process. So we look at it as an employee that may not be as capable as other employees, but can get this one thing done consistently well, given the tools that it has access to. And when we constrain the domain of the problem to that, it becomes both tractable and also delivers consistently with quality what is expected of it, which is very much the way we're thinking about shaping this.
It's also nice because, you have that Slack or Teams conversation, right? So you have an audit trail. Where did the answers come from? Why did this go into this RFP, right? I think that's super powerful. And especially, you know, with Michelle here talking about investing in tech for regulated industries, like that's core. That has to be there for adoption to take place, I think.
Yeah. And the one, if you go to our website, it says kiss your apps goodbye. And the reason for that is we have SaaS fatigue. Right. We've got way too many apps to log into. And when you hire a new person on your team, what are you doing? You're telling them, hey, here's a Google Drive folder. There's like 500 bajillion documents you have to read over the course of the next 30, 60, 90 days. Oh, and by the way, here are the licenses that you need to 17 systems that we use. And you can swivel chair from system to system and you can figure out how to use them after you've ingested all these docs. I was like, huh, that looks like a really good pattern for some sort of RAG-based workflow with an agent that can go to those systems and do stuff. It's like, okay, let's do that.
Yeah, I got to ask Michelle, like, as you think about underwriting, right? Like, this sounds like a slam dunk.
Yeah, I literally, as he was giving that answer, I was like, okay, so all the business lines that have very straightforward, standardized, like, question sets or data that comes in, you know, how do you start just having one of those agents be the one to triage, raise the main points that's coming out of that main application or submission, and then push that through? Or even the ones that are non-standard, just going through and raising, like, this is missing, this is here, like, there's nothing to extract from this, and then pushing it forward. I my mind also went somewhere else as you were talking about, we had on a on a previous episode, someone talking about agents and this idea of building or having multiple agents available to connect workflows that were previously somewhat disparate because they were part of workflows that were part of like siloed systems or things like that. And so as you're talking about building an agent for this very specific capability that, you know, whether Tribble's doing it or just generally thinking about an agent that's very good at this, mm-hmm. how do you think about connecting or expanding that agent to be able to do like two steps of this pretty standard workflow? And like, what are the challenges there? Like of, you know, human in the loop and keeping someone apprised mm-hmm. of that, or what are the rules and things that may have to change as part of a workflow to do that?
Yeah, it's also the namesake of the company. Like we've got many Tribbles that can, you know, they're multiple copies of each other and they do the same thing. Or do we have different Tribbles themselves that all do and specialize in different things? And I think we've wrestled with this as well. And I think right now with the focus of where we're at, it seems to us that the right thing to do is to give the Tribble skills, and the skills can vary over time. So right now it just happens to really be good at retrieving information from specific classes of documents and specific systems. It is really good at producing specific shapes of output when it comes to documents and proposals. But in the future, it might also be able to cobble together some videos and create some demos that an SE would do. But that becomes a skill you add to Tribble, the entity, which then has multiple copies of itself. So I think this discussion of like, do you need to partition parts of the process into different workflows and then have agents specialized in each thing? Or do you need to just have an agent? I look at it as a very capable employee. Like you can choose to have two people that are specialized in two different domains and have them as two people serving those functions, or you can have one person and a copy of both person, but like, you know, give them different access to different tools and have them do different things. So I think it really comes down to how you're thinking about expanding the core product and whether or not there are any inherent benefits from having like some sort of domain segmentation across the agents. I'm not convinced either way, actually. I feel like it's an area of research where I haven't seen anything definitive. I'm curious to get Chris's thoughts on this one.
No, I think I have so many thoughts about this. One, I think the possibilities are endless if you think about the tools you could arm a Tribble with or an agent with. As you were talking about this, I was thinking, why isn't there one that just watches Slack conversations and looks for common questions answered and like auto builds your FAQ for the organization, right?
Funny you should bring that up. That is actually one of the things we ingest. So we specify.
No, not at all. We just great minds and all that. That's it. But you know, that almost functions as like a meta agent, right? And so what does it look like? I talked about, you know, endless specialization is possible, but then what happens if you start breeding the Tribbles, right? And you combine the capabilities, right? Can you really build a generalist from these things?
I'm getting some Tamagotchi memories from years ago.
Yeah. I was just thinking of the quote from the great Dr. Leonard McCoy. As far as I can tell, they're born pregnant. but like what actually happens, right? Like can you go from specialist to generalist the same way that happens in an organization, right? Like someone who's been underwriting one line of business for years and then switches lines, eventually they just kind of know everything about underwriting your organization. I think we have a few years before I can really answer that question definitively, Sonny.
Hey, go ahead, Michelle.
No, if you have something on that point to Chris, please drop it, because I was going to go back to something else that you said previously.
Yeah, I was just going to unpack that a little bit more, because I think the general purpose nature of the agent space, like ultimately you're conversing with this thing that's, I said this yesterday in this meeting as well. It's like everyone is chasing the omniscient thing, right? It's like basically it's like plug it to a bunch of things, it learns and it's able to do whatever task you throw at it. And those tasks become ever more complex with the more capable foundational models that are going to come out in the future. So let's assume that that's like at some point in the future, Delta T, that's going to happen. So it's like, okay, what's tractable now? And how do you think about use cases today? Well, we still have this world with humans and UXs, and we like to use these tools in different systems. So it's like, how can we build a scaffold or a UX to interface with the agent that is very grafted to the workflow, but it's like conversational plus plus. It's not just pure play conversation, because most people suck at asking questions or knowing what to ask, right? Which then is the problem, because you come, like, it's like when we go into a restaurant, you see a menu with 2000 items. It's like, I don't know what I want, right? And then you just don't do anything. So I feel that that's kind of what happens when you just take this super capable thing and dump it into a conversational interface, unless you give some guide rails on like, how do you interact with it? What kind of value can you get? So the opportunity for us has been, hey, can you build the scaffold around this RFP use case to guide them through what their business process looks like? So that's kind of one. So when we talk about skills, like the skill comes with this kind of grafting. So you probably don't want to shove every possible UX and make this an omniscient thing, right? So like, there's probably this intermediary phase where you have like these scaffolds around the capability that get these business processes done. But then the question over time is like, do you even need that? Right. And this is where I think it gets a little bit tricky.
I'll just go back to something else you were talking about. My mind went to, Chris, to broker use cases also for agents and something like this, where, so when you're thinking about it from the carrier perspective, right, they're getting all of these submissions and things like that. But then there's the responses that come from the carriers back to the brokers, and they're then having to create, put these packages together of, you know, here's all of the policy information and offering from each of the carriers that we've gone out to. Here, you know, customer of mine now pick, like, the being able to automate that. And I don't know what's happening in that space today. This is a call out to any broker that may be listening, like, to come join and have a conversation with us. But I think that I spend a lot of time thinking about AI and use cases from the carrier perspective, but for sure there's a large number of them that would be helpful and add efficiencies and automations in the broker world as well. I don't know, Chris, if you had any thoughts on that also, but that's where my mind went when suddenly you were talking about just pulling in all these like various sets of information and packaging it up.
No, I'm right there with you. I think the paradigm that Sonny's describing, which is treat it like it's a coworker and give it access to the things it needs and clear instructions for how to get back the right thing, I think that's a great paradigm and abstracts across a lot of different industries and roles.
Yeah. And I'll jump in, Michelle, just because brokers did come up in the conversations with a couple of insurance companies. It's just that
you and I did not rehearse this, but
yeah, but it is so relevant, right? Because it's like, essentially these representatives for your company, right? And you want them to be able to take this vast amount of information and represent it consistently and accurately while they're serving the channel. And if there are any back and forths with the end customer, then you want to equip them with everything possible to do their job well, right? And I think this is where, you know, I was actually talking to a leader at one of these big software companies just a couple hours ago, actually, and we were talking about the consistency of responses across their global team varies greatly as a function of available capacity. So it's like, hey, like if people are busy, they're going to very quickly go through this stuff and fill it out. Quality takes a hit, but if you're optimizing for just getting everything done, your consistency and quality varies, right? And it's a function of what capacity is available on the team. So it's like even normalizing that curve has inherent benefit, because your win rates or your potential, you know, your end-to-end experience with a customer goes up, and that has a positive impact in the business. So I think the broker model is very much an area ripe from, at least from what I'm hearing from customers, ripe for disruption given the document heavy process that's in place.
I think we're going to see it on the consumer side as well. Like, you want to buy insurance, right? Progressive has their tool, whatever it's called, that finds the right insurance for you. Like, why do I have to fill in anything in a website? Why don't I just have an agent that goes out and shops for me? Like, same with travel. Like, here's where I want to go, rough dates, like, you know, meet the criteria, find this stuff for me. Like, I think that's coming. And eventually it's going to be a world where it's just our agents talking to your agents, and you know, we're all on an island somewhere, maybe, hopefully.
Your agent does a good job booking your trip.
That's right. Yeah.
And by the way, I'm not sure, like, I know the GPTs are out there and what OpenAI released, like the assistants, like that, it can already do a set of things. And actually, when you configure the assistants, you can provide APIs and you can ask it to access specific systems. What we've noticed in our testing is, and this is like the best foundational models, I think where things tend to fall apart is the complexity of the task, especially in a B2B setting. you can have NAPIs that are exposed as tools to the model. The model's ability to select the right tool, like the combinatorial explosion of adding 15 systems and the complexity of the task and the depth of complexity of the task within that system, all play a role in like its ability to act. So it's almost like there's like this, you know, I think back to this curve. I think it was, I don't remember who it was, but there was like this curve of like intelligence, right? And it's like compute versus intelligence. And it maps like different organisms in terms of like what their compute capacity is. Like, I think where the models are right now is still, you know, this is what the whole concept of AGI, they're not at the point yet where you can throw 15 systems at them and it'll figure it out every single time. Right. Yep. But not too far off, I think, is a time where the foundational model, you can now throw more and more tools at it and just have it figure it out.
Absolutely. I want to circle back. You were talking about some of the obstacles, security, mm-hmm. obviously, throughput, things like that. One of the, in my experience, largest obstacles to adoption of new technology is just the people who have to use that new technology. So like, as you're out there deploying your tribbles, are you seeing like that organizational immune response to new technologies, or is it feeling like it's seamless for them and they're adopting it well?
You know, when it was in earlier days for the company, when we were exploring kind of like, hey, how do we, this is like magical. Like, you can put this in the hands of people and they can get so much value out of it. But if you don't precisely tell them how to use it, it doesn't get adopted. Right. And I think that's been like the first learning, which is conversational interfaces are great. It's really hard to build a consistent habit or workflow around it in a business setting, unless there's a repeated thing you're going to it for. So that's why this focus on the RFP use case made a lot of sense for us, because it's an established business process. There are people in the company that are responsible for doing it. And we can kind of look at the existing workflow and interject into that. And that becomes the place where you reinforce the way to retrieve information. So that's been a good way to like attach or graft yourself to an existing business process.
For you, reverse a little bit of what you just said, right? So it sounds like that insurer that you were working with had a very specific, had what I'll call at least a fairly good understanding of what's available in the Gen AI landscape, and had identified already a business case that they wanted to pursue testing that technology and those capabilities with. In your experience in talking to either insurance carriers or larger enterprises, how often are you finding that to be the room you're walking into versus a room where it's like, we've got to do something with Gen AI, what can we do? And just kind of leaving it like open book. Because I feel like it's probably split where there's, I think we were talking about this earlier, where there's companies who are like, we don't want to be behind. We have to find something to do Gen AI. What are all the big things we can do? And they don't come in with a plan or something to really test, versus others that have maybe an innovation group or someone that is very focused on really identifying like viable AI solutions to bring in that will be longer term, part of the longer term strategy.
I think it's a fair point, Michelle, like we're seeing both. And, you know, I think back to my Salesforce days where the company evolved fairly fast and the platform, the core Salesforce platform, was built in such a way that you could build any use case out on it. So a lot of the times you'd have these executives that are like, hey, I made this big investment. Like, what other things can I build on this thing? Like, let's ideate. Let's come up with all the different ways in which we could use this wonderful thing. I kind of feel a little bit of that now when we go into conversations where it's like, hey, like help us identify the highest leverage or the highest value use cases. And a few conversations do end up like that. It's very exploratory, almost consultative, if you will, about what makes sense. I think for us, it's been really important to like identify where there is acute pain in an existing process and walk in with a point of view on that, as opposed to making it a very broad use case exploration kind of discussion. And those tend to be the better, you know, better discussions to have when you're an early stage company and, you know, adding customers, right? I think to your question about just in terms of what we're seeing in that vertical, I think, you know, there are people that don't know what an LLM is, right? Like, which is like one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum, it's like, hey, we have a mandate to figure something out in the next 3 months for these domain areas. And there's like a full spectrum there of like education. So I think it really matters at the company. And, you know, I, once again, there's a bias working a lot with tech companies for us. We tend to walk into meetings, like assuming a level of knowledge in this space, but there are people out there that just are not ingrained in this day to day like us. Right. So I think you have to appreciate the fact that there's some education needed in some conversations.
Do you find in your experience, and I know it's early days and every company does things differently, but do you find that the stages from that initial meeting to getting something approved to go through and then launching whatever it is, a pilot or full engagement, that those steps are impacted by which room you're walking into? Meaning, is it harder to get things approved if they're very specific on what they want and they kind of have buy-in? Or is it they're so open to it that like they'll still push it through? Like what's the dynamic there? Like, who's the decision maker? Are they already identified for you based on the room that you're in, or are they like kind of spinning their wheels a bit as you go through?
I think with the focus on the use case, the buyer is pretty clear. And this is why, you know, for me and what my guidance to the team is always, we don't talk about AI. It's a business process that we're helping you make better. And we think that there's at least a 10x improvement in this specific process. It just happens to be using AI as a technology underneath the hood and all the great stuff that's coming out. And then, of course, there are some questions around, like, we've never seen anything move this fast. So are you as a company thinking about that? Because we don't want to place our bet with you and then, you know, 6 months later have to change to something else because the stuff is moving at a blistering pace. And the answer to that is like, yes, we're thinking about that. It keeps us up every night. And in fact, we build the company in a way where you can swap out the engine as the more capable things come out. We don't think you can survive if you don't build a company in that way, right? And then that typically alleviates that conversation. But I think the way to do it, Michelle, is most people are looking either for, you know, if you're a hammer looking for a nail, that's kind of like the, hey, AI, let's go find a solution or space to find a solution, which is probably not a good discussion to be in as an early stage company. But if you're feeling acute pain somewhere and we're coming in and we're talking about pain medicine for that pain, AI can be the way to solve it or not. And I think this is just the better way to look at it always. At least that's what, you know, is working for us.
I'm curious, are you seeing IT trying to insert itself in these conversations, saying things like, oh, we'll just build it. You don't need to buy that from those guys.
I literally had this conversation 2 days ago. We're investigating if we can just build this on ChatGPT. And, you know, it's like, once again, it's like deja vu. It's like, oh, wow. Yeah. I remember this in like, you know, 10 years ago, AWS has this beautiful portfolio of services that you can cobble together and build software on. You've got an IT department that, you know, used to manage servers. They've got more time now because everything's on cloud, so they can build this stuff, right? It's like, great. I had, and once again, I'll go back to my previous employer, Salesforce. It's like, oh, we can just buy the platform license and rebuild the core sales cloud ourselves. It's like, you could do that, but then, you know, you're not going to have the team behind managing it as a product. And you're now splitting your company's focus. So it's like this age old build versus buy, but I think it's more happening more acutely now because it's a much higher percentage of where you, how far you can get out of the box with some of these, right? It's pretty convincing. The demos are really good. And I think that the tech allows you to create these POCs that are much more complete than they would have been 5 years ago had you tried to cobble something yourself, which I think is actually really dangerous, right? Because it's like the illusion of working end to end. But then what happens is like, yeah, it's like when you have a consulting project and a POC built, it's not a product. It's something that was built for that engagement, right? And then it's like, who's maintaining it? Who's keeping it up to date? How do you manage it? The whole product life cycle is gone.
Well, I think go ahead, Chris.
No, I was just going to say it takes me back to the days of like doing proofs of concept as a data scientist where it's like, look at this awesome Jupyter notebook I created. And it's like, yeah, what the hell am I looking at? It made a chart. I don't get it. Right. But now your middleware developer, your backend developer, they can put in a little bit of code and get out the JavaScript. So it has a front end and obviously much more convincing. So I'm right there with you. Go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, I was going to say, I like the way you talked about that, like what really goes into the build versus buy and like the longer term impacts of that. And the one thing I'd add to that too is, you know, once you do split that focus, right. And then let's say you do successfully internally build what you were looking to buy. You're then stuck I imagine, supporting that single thing that you built. So any innovation that's happening on that platform or that technology, that company that was selling it to you, that they're moving forward, they're adding enhancements, they're expanding capabilities, your built product isn't doing that because it only knows what's happening within the four walls of your company. And so to then expand capabilities there, that's a whole different initiative, most likely, and a whole different project than just having something naturally grow and just have some resources there to support it. So I, my completely unbiased opinion is obviously on the buy versus build side. But I think especially with new technology, the hype cycle is happening and it's hot and fast and people are just like, well, maybe the differentiators that we do it. I think people really need to look hard at that and they need to understand what they want it for and how long that builds.
I think
needs to be relevant.
Michelle, I think that's exactly right. Like the build versus buy, the allure of wanting to use this technology to build, it looks so easy to do. So people are infatuated with the idea of very quickly standing things up. I mean, look, even for us, like we're a fairly small company. We've been around for a year. We're growing really fast, but it's not lost on me that, you know, if we've got a whole bunch of RFPs and InfoSecs coming in, well, we of course use Tribble to answer those things because that's the core product. If we see a feature is lacking, we'll build it because we make it part of the product and then we sell it to our customers. So that's a straightforward thing to do. But if I need something for social media posting, I'm not going to put my engineering capacity to build that out using AI. It doesn't make sense. It's away from the core product. So it's like, buy a product for that unless it's part of the core. And I think sometimes you lose focus of that when you have highly capable folks that are in these different functions that can also experiment with technology. And the question I think most people have to ask themselves is like, is this what my customers are asking for from me? Or am I building this as a pet project that I then have to dedicate engineering capacity and cost to? What's the strategic benefit of that?
Yeah. Why do you think there's an arbitrage there, right? Like unless you have some inside information, there's some secret sauce in the organization that means you would build it better and it would stay better long-term. Like it's naive at best. And I think dangerous at worst.
Yeah. Focus, right? That's the discussion.
Yep. You're talking about selling and talking to tech companies a lot. I can see, you know, the stuff that you're building out, that you're selling, being complementary to a lot of other solutions. So how do you, with all of this Gen AI going on and companies kind of looking the same, how is the collaborative versus competitive landscape looking among Gen AI startups these days?
I think there's going to be a mass rationalization of co-pilots. I feel like it's like if there are co-pilots for every single thing, we've created this ridiculously massive fragmentation of functionality, right? So we're now moving away from like having SaaS apps to the co-pilots for everything.
It's
like
kiss your co-pilots goodbye.
Exactly. So I mean, I don't know how this plays out long term. I feel as though, you know, when you look at the big software companies, they've always been about bring everything to our ecosystem. We offer you a functionality or capability for everything you need. But if you talk to most CIOs, like the landscape is there are many systems in place, right? So I think aggregators of functionality across systems who make it easier for you to operate across existing processes and systems, there's benefit there. And there's probably some platform leverage for some of the big guys to say, hey, we can do all these flows together and that'll make buying easier. I do, from a competitive standpoint, you know, I think if you're in this space of we are a sales co-pilot, it is a massive ocean and differentiation is near impossible. And for us, like if you're very much in the space of RFP response software, you know, and you're using this approach to solve for that, it narrows down the field. And we just last week, you know, on G2, we're now rated the number three software from an RFP response standpoint based on user reviews and customer reviews and feedback, right? And that's squarely been a function of the step change improvement that we can offer our customers given the tech. So narrowing the focus and reducing the playing field, if you will, I think makes it a little bit more tractable and less competitive. But there is just a lot of companies out there that are trying to do stuff in this space.
You sort of go ahead.
No, I have a question. So if you got a comment, you go first.
No. I was gonna ask a question. You do it.
In that lens, if I'm the insurance carrier on a large enterprise, what are the right questions that I should be asking these startups in this landscape to really get to identifying the right capabilities and the right solution that for what I need, that's who I need to partner with?
It's a great question. One of the early lessons that we learned, like within the second month of operation, because we wanted to sell to enterprise from day one, SOC 2 compliance, just immediate certification and building on infrastructure that scales. There are so many open source libraries that you can pick up and hack together a solution in a weekend that's very convincing from a demo standpoint. And that's scary because you can dress that up fairly quickly from a UX standpoint, show it to people, and then get them excited. And then the question becomes like, is this built on scalable, secure infrastructure? I think the kinds of questions I would ask as a buyer is like, what are you built on? How are you handling my data? What can it scale to? What's your maximum throughput? How many users can you handle concurrently? How's your infrastructure built to scale? All questions that we've come across and had to come up with answers for over the course of the last year. Actually, fun fact, we determined our theoretical maximum throughput thanks to something that happened. I won't name the specific provider, but basically it exposed like the total maximum throughput of all the model deployments we have in Azure of the tokens per second we can get to a theoretical max. And it was great because we can essentially handle like, I think something in the order of like 25 GPT-4 32K calls per second consistently for hours, which is...
I don't know what you just said, but it sounded really impressive.
Yeah. I'm just looking at Chris's face. So it's like, in order to do that, that was a lot of infrastructure work from the engineering team over the course of the last 6-7 months. Now, nowhere do we never hit that kind of load at that frequency, but it's good to know because you know that you've built it in a scalable way, right? And I think, Michelle, to your question, for enterprise, what's important? Well, it's consistency of service, it's security, scalability. And I think the experience of the team that comes to the table knowing to work with enterprise is crucial as well, because the way you work with an enterprise and work with those teams, fundamentally different from PLG sales where you sell it and kind of move on. You just have time, right? And that's been a differentiator for us as well.
You kind of touched on this earlier with the sort of the lower grade BDR maybe coming up a little bit. I'm not convinced of that. I think the lower quality might just get to doing bad work faster with some tools. Not yours. Tribble won't allow that, but some of these tools out there.
Amplifying the not so good.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the distribution in a lot of cases becomes very bimodal. And I think we're seeing that already in like people are forgetting best practices with software because it's so easy to get software out, right?
Yeah.
They're forgetting best practices with model rigor because, it just gave me an answer and it was so quick and easy. Like, why should I test it? Why should I have a suite of tests? Well, maybe because the model checkpoint's going to change in 3 months, right? Like, it's madness. So all of that leading up to this, my favorite question, and you already touched a little bit on it with the great Copilot reckoning that you've predicted. We're going to timestamp that one. Looking into the crystal ball, and you tell me what the time horizon is, what do you think in terms of the impact of generative AI in the enterprise, what do you think the next big wave is? And on what timeline?
I say this to my team all the time. I think the speed with which, like I even just used as a proxy, like this 1 million token context window development that's popped out, right? I think Chris, like we talked about a year ago when it was like 32K context. Holy crap, that's insane. Imagine all the things you can do, right? Well, now guess what? You can take an entire 200-page government RFP, throw it into either Cloud 3 or into Gemini 1.5 and extract from it every entity that makes sense to understand and get a very good understanding of that doc, right? So that's a significant step change than what was available a year ago, right? And I feel as though in 2 years' time, 3 years' time, it becomes very hard to predict how fast things are moving. If the trend holds that, you know, if you just increase compute, the model scale, which seems to be true, right? And that's what everyone's doing. And that's why NVIDIA is worth over $2 trillion. Then the speed with which things change is also going to stay constant, at least, you know, whatever you want to call this rate of change. For us, you know, I think when you think about the next wave, it comes back to the conversation about the ability to reason, the ability to use more tools. I think it's agents. I think it's ever more complex workflows and tasks. And we'll likely hit an inflection point of the percentage of work being done by an individual being done completely autonomously, and the need for the same distribution of individuals in those roles. And I think what's not happened yet is, once again, it comes back to like this, the great copilot reckoning will come when copilots are no longer needed, because agents will be able to do a large percentage of these work, and they don't need to be attached to a human. They can be independent of the human. And now your ratio between human and agent changes, and that distribution changes over time. So I think we're going to eat into the OPEX for the workforce over time. And that to me is the next point in time. And I don't know if that happens in 3 years, 5 years, but best guess, I can't see past three. That's the way I look at it.
I'm with you.
That was great. I think that sounds like a great place to end, since none of us know what's happening after 3 years from now. So,
but in the meantime, we can help you with your RFP problems over here at Tribble. So
yeah.
There you have it. Thank you everyone for listening to the latest episode of Unstructured Unlocked. We've had Sunil Rao, the founder and CEO of Tribble, join us today. Thanks so much for chatting with us.
Good Thank times. You for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Unstructured Unlocked. You can find all of our episodes wherever you listen to podcasts today. Be sure to write a review if you like what you hear.